On WGN. Hi, it's John Williams. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We appreciate your listening. We are here on weekdays from noon to one. You're also able to hear me 9 to noon, and then the Wintrust Business Lunch noon to one. Pete McMurray's filling in for me tomorrow. I'll be well tomorrow, but well, I won't be here. I'll be doing a couple of things I got to take care of tomorrow and then back in the saddle on Thursday. A postscript to our show from just a moment ago, though. A guy called in and said that he is a little troubled by seeing hospital workers, nurses, technicians, doctors in grocery stores still wearing their scrubs, the clothes that they would wear that you'd recognize in a hospital. He thinks that they should be in civilian clothes. If they're in peril at the hospital, maybe they shouldn't then be going to the grocery store with those same clothes on. 708 texted in and said, family member is a hospital worker and they have to change to clean scrubs before they leave. I don't know how widespread that rule is, but Ravi, if you're still listening, maybe it's not the sort of thing that should alarm you the way you said it did. And I've also heard from some of you who said that there was a story in the Chicago Tribune on Sunday about the Door County Hospital and that they tripled their ICU beds there from 4 to 12. Point is, they don't want a lot of Illinoisans going up to their Door County or Wisconsin homes or cabins right now. And some of you are being told quite specifically not to come up yet. So when do we open up the golf courses and the tennis courts and the basketball courts and the restaurants and bars in Wisconsin and in Illinois? There's a lot of interesting conversation about what's going on in Naperville right now, one of the bigger and more prosperous cities in the Chicagoland area. And the mayor there on his private Facebook page said that he is on board opening up sooner than later. He said, I want to be reasonable about it, but I do think we need to pay more attention to that. He did not put that on the Facebook page of the mayor's office. But when you're the mayor, I don't know that the platform you're using or the page you're using matters that much. He said, I'm not going to be the one that makes the call, but he's the mayor of that town. So we'll continue to follow that story. Anna DeVlantis will visit with him after 1 o'clock. What's the plan there, Naperville? John Najarian, jump in on that part of the conversation. I don't know where health news and business news begin and end anymore. They're just so intertwined, aren't they?
Absolutely they are, John, because it's all now about two things. When do we reopen? And is there a double dip? Not just a double dip in the market, but if people can reinfect, which we don't know for sure yet. We don't know whether or not they just sort of the symptoms abate for a little bit and then, you know, come back and it's not a reinfection, or whether it's an actual reinfection. But anyway, you're absolutely right, John. You can't separate health from the economy right now because one is a trigger for the other.
John Najarian, of course, is the founder of MarketRebellion.com, a financial news education and subscription service. He'll have some stock information for us and maybe a pick of the day. But that is the conversation I've been having with researchers and modelers the last few days, too, John. And that is, we'll give you the information. We're the scientists or we're the medical experts. But at the end of the day, a civilian is going to have to make a medically based decision for when do we open these businesses back up. What's the threshold? How much infection are you willing to allow in your communities to get the businesses rolling again? And I don't know that there's much of a precedent for them on how to make that decision.
You're right. And I've been listening to Dr. Scott Gottlieb and Dr. Fauci, both of whom experts in virology, and both of them said, look, we already know that a number of people are dying, not of COVID, but because of COVID, because they won't go in for their chemotherapy, because they have conditions that you would say you are likely to have experienced a stroke, but the person is not willing to go into the hospital and get what might have been a life-saving shot of a certain enzyme that, you know, can help a stroke situation not be as adverse to the person's health going forward if you get it in time. But there are so many people that are avoiding hospitals completely right now that are either dying already and or are going to be dying in the future because, again, if you're skipping chemo and or if you're skipping issues with your heart or other, you are definitely contributing more to the death rate, even if it's not a COVID death that's related to it.
Yeah. I like the way you put that a little more specifically. That kind of language has been coming out of the White House for a while, but I wasn't exactly sure what that meant, except a depressed economy means healthcare generally is depressed, but specifically if you're foregoing treatment, if you're not going to the doctor when you should be, you would be a victim in a way of COVID as well. I wanted to ask you about oil prices. I want to ask you about what's happening on the stock market today. I know you've got a few things to say about that. John Najarian's on a phone line, founder of MarketRebellion.com, financial news, education, subscription service. I just wanted to ask you about something that I'm trying to get my head around, John, and maybe I'm not alone on this these days. It says here in the New York Times that the benchmark price for crude oil in the United States fell to negative $37.63. They say that means if you happen to be in a position to take delivery of 1,000 barrels of oil in Cushing, Oklahoma, in the month of May, the quantity quoted in the relevant futures contract, you have been paid a cool $37,630 to do so. They give you the oil and $37,000. The price for crude is negative $37.63. And what am I talking about here?
Yeah, and this is one of the weird things about that contract, and we could talk for hours about it, but I'll just tell you some of the facts, that, and then you can go where you will with them. Essentially, a negative price in this future indicates exactly what you said, that you will be paid to take delivery. And why would that be? You know, there has to be a value to crude oil, and there is. The problem is that there is no storage for it. So a bunch of my friends, John, were joking on Twitter yesterday. These are broadcasters for various networks. And they were saying, well, there's a big empty parking lot in for the Mets or for the Giants and Jets. Maybe we should just get a bunch of trucks and park them there full of oil. And that would be actually a great idea, except you can't find any movable piece of metal that will hold crude oil right now. Every single bit of that is spoken for, and they're paying 10 times or 15 times the daily rate already just to store it. Because in simple terms, this is what people do. When crude oil gets this cheap and you can sell the future price of crude oil as you could yesterday for $27, that was the June contract, actually 25, I guess. If you could get it at zero effectively, forget about negative, just zero, and sell it forward 1 month out for $25, you would do that forever. The problem is that you have to price in the storage because, of course, the EPA won't just let you dump it into a swimming pool. You've got to have an approved facility to hold it. Pipelines are approved. Also, you know, those big tanks that we see down in Whiting, Indiana, and so forth, those kind of things are approved. But you can't just take crude oil and just dump it someplace and hold it. Plus, it would get, obviously, debris and so forth in it if it were exposed. So it would become worthless. So in other words, since those futures are negative, they will pay you to take delivery because that's better than them having to dump it, which they cannot do because, again, the EPA would fine the heck out of anybody who did that. So this is the real conundrum right here, is that there is so much crude because the demand is only, according to friends of mine at the New York Merck, the former New York Merck, which is owned by, of course, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange or the Intercontinental Exchange, that's an all-electronic energy exchange based in Atlanta. They say maybe the demand is for 60% of refined crude right now. As far as the rest of it, there is no demand. There is less than zero demand for the rest of it. And yet, even with the agreement that Saudi and the Russians came to in the meeting last week, the problem is that that cutback doesn't start until May 1st. So they are still overproducing like crazy, and this is a mutually assured destruction. They are just wrecking the price of crude oil.
And that liquid crude gets refined into gas and other petroleum products. But since we're driving less, we don't need gasoline. We don't need all of those products right now. People aren't buying anything. And so the crude sits there. It's got nowhere to go.
Yep. It's right now they're filling pipelines. So pipelines where it would normally move through from one point to another. You've heard about that XL pipeline, and they wanted to extend it out of Canada down to Cushing and so forth. Those pipelines are full and not moving right now because they're being used as storage facilities.
Wow.
All those tankers out on the ocean are floating storage. They are exhausting all of these methods of storage, and I'm sure they're dumping it into salt caves, as they already have done as far as our strategic petroleum reserve. But other parts of the world have the same, and they're doing the same. There's just no place to put all this crude right now.
And we've got refineries in the Chicagoland area. I wonder if they are slowing or stopping their production then.
Well, I'm guessing that they've cut way back on the refining, whether it's diesel or Jet A. Obviously, both of those cut back dramatically, and gasoline. But I got to believe that those tanks that they've got are full, and they probably thought they were stealing it when they were buying it at $12 a barrel. And by the way, each of these futures is 1,000 barrels. So if you took delivery of just one, that's 1,000 barrels of crude oil. That's basically what is in one of these trucks when you see it making deliveries to an Exxon station or a Mobil station or whatever.
That's 1,000 barrels,
yeah, these are huge contracts.
Gas prices at the pump are generally a pretty good indication of what's happening with the economy, though, right? Lower prices mean the economy is suffering a little bit. The demand is low. We're not doing as much. I guess the same is true for crude as well, even though one comes a little bit after the other. And gas prices are really low. And I guess that's the same thing, isn't it, John? People kind of joke, well, I'll come over with a couple of cartons and get me some gas. But we as consumers don't have any way to lock in future gas prices for ourselves, do we?
Well, you could trade. They do have futures on it. You could trade them. But just as today's information has indicated to you, you don't really have there's nothing you can do if it goes into negative. No one is used to ever seeing somebody pay you to take that commodity. But that's what they will do right now. In the case of crude, it hasn't happened yet in gasoline, but it could happen in gasoline as well.
I'm just wondering a scenario, though, where, like, I've been buying gift cards to restaurants and I give you the cash with the promise that I'll take receipt of the food later on. I'd love to do that at a gas station. I'll walk into the one on the corner of my street and give them $1.79 for a gallon. I'll buy 50 gallons and then
sure.
I'll just get a card good for 50 gallons of gas, mind you, at $1.79. And then when it goes up to $3 a gallon, I'll still have that many gallons on my card. But there's no such program out there, is there?
No. And again, their problem is the same as the one we're discussing right now. They have nowhere to put it. So they'd love to take advantage of a negative price for crude or a super cheap price for refined products like diesel and gasoline, but they just have nowhere to put it.
Now, the markets have been affected by a number of things. Maybe it's the price of crude. Maybe it was Gilead saying that maybe they do have something that will treat COVID-19. What's most affecting the markets this week or today?
Well, today it really is just that crude, because there's a massive contract, an ETF called the USO, and this tracks the price of crude oil, and this one may be forced to shut down. It's down to $2.52. It's lost 32% of its value today. It was a multi-billion dollar ETF, exchange-traded fund, that tracks crude oil. But the problem is that they hedge. They create this ETF by purchasing futures. And right now, those futures that we've discussed are in negative territory. They've rolled out to June and July already, but this could conceivably go to zero. We've never had a stock go into negative. In other words, somebody pays you to take the stock, but it would it could be that this one is going to have to shut down, and this would be a very big ETF. And when big ETFs like this meet this kind of destruction, a lot of people get nervous, and that's obviously reflected in the 500 points that the Dow is down, although we are off the lows, at least so far today.
Any stocks you're liking or disliking particularly? I know Amy Guth, our colleague, is going to talk about what's happening with Coca-Cola, a company, maybe less so about the stock price, but what companies are you looking at today?
Well, we've still got Netflix coming out with earnings in just a bit. And that one, I mean, they are doing everything right now. And talk about the ultimate inverse of anything to do with COVID. We're watching more because we're staying home. Their costs of these shows they're airing, they're just crushing the competition because they have so many more viewers that they can pay more if they need to, and the competition can't. So they are a pure play, and Netflix continues to just astound with the move that it's made in the last 2 weeks.
Well, I don't buy individual equities. I don't know how many of our listeners do, but if they did, I wonder if it's going to be hard to get much of a return on an investment in Netflix right now.
It's going to be harder. I think you could certainly look at some of these right now people are looking and saying, wow, the market is, you know, it's, for instance, the NASDAQ is down, I think, 5% coming into the day today, and then lost more today. But meanwhile, Netflix is up 34%. I'm just going to hold on to Netflix and stay short in the market because this is the one that is putting up positive earnings. And the rest of it is opaque. We have no idea what the earnings will be from companies you mentioned. Amy's going to talk about IBM. But how can any of these other companies give you positive guidance going forward because of what's going on in the world? But obviously Netflix can.
That's a point that I think Bob Surratt was making this morning, too. He had another financial advisor on, and they said that a lot of the traditional reportings about earnings and forecasting just doesn't mean as much right now. We're in such an anomaly. So really, what's, say, a mutual fund buyer or a stock buyer to do? What information do you trade on right now?
Right. Well, again, there are just a handful of companies, maybe there are two handfuls, that are, if not immune to COVID, are benefiting from it. You know, the likes of Zoom or GoToMeeting, those kinds of companies are benefiting from it. You mentioned Gilead. Obviously, anybody in the therapeutic space that even has a chance at coming up with a treatment or working on a vaccine, those stocks have exploded. So those would be where I would be looking. In therapeutics, in the communications area, whether it's even a stock like Comcast, I mean, I don't see us cutting back on a cable right now because that's your communication to the world, not only telephone, but obviously your television and your Wi-Fi. So things like Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, as well as the GoToMeeting and LogMeIn, as well as Zoom, are just hugely popular and just growing by leaps and bounds every day.
John Najarian is the founder of MarketRebellion.com, financial news education subscription service. Let's visit again. Thanks for your time and expertise, as always, John.
Well, thank you, John. Have a great day and stay safe.
That's the plan. Let's spend a few minutes then with the Ronald McDonald House Charities of Chicagoland, Northwest Indiana's chief executive officer, Holly Buckendahl, joins us. Ronald McDonald House Charities actually partners with the folks at Wintrust, and Holly's joining us now to talk a little bit about how they are managing in the COVID crisis. Holly, welcome back. You're on WGN. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back.
For those who don't, I think most of us are very familiar with the name and generally what you all do, but tell us what Ronald McDonald Charities does.
Well, absolutely. As you know, John, we're here to help keep families together and close to foster hospitalized child during times of critical childhood illness. And so between our five Ronald McDonald houses, three family rooms inside hospitals, and then our two Caremobiles. We are doing all we can here in Chicago to help kids, keep kids healthy and safe, and really keep these families together during really terrifying times.
Are there a lot of families using the services, or is it because maybe fewer people are actually getting traditional medical procedures? The demand is less for you right now.
Yeah, you know, childhood illness doesn't know any time, schedule, or boundaries. And so our focus right now, as we are always an essential partner to our pediatric healthcare partners, is we are absolutely still taking care of families whose children remain in the ICU units of our hospitals. And so they need us now more than ever. But you're right. Some of the other sorts of surgical procedures that can wait are, and we know that we'll have a floodgate of more families that are coming to stay with us once we get behind this COVID-19 stuff. But we're still, you know, sitting at about 40% full at four of our five Ronald McDonald houses that remain open today. And one of our family rooms inside Lurie Children's Hospital is still busy as ever. And our other two family rooms in particular are responding to needs of our healthcare workers inside those hospitals. So we're busy, we're open, and here to help the community and these sick kids and their families.
Are those families from the Chicago area generally, or are they from all around the country?
They could be from anywhere, really. You know, from a Chicagoland perspective, they could be 15, 20, 30 miles out. Predominantly, we're serving, mostly our families are from Indiana and Illinois, but last year we served families from, you know, more than 45 states. So we do have some long-term families that are staying with us, and they've been with us for months, and they are hunkered down getting care. And so we are their home away from home right now. And doing our best to keep everybody connected and close.
How do you keep them safe? What do you do when you have people staying there? It's not their home, and presumably they're having interaction with hospital staff or their kids.
Yeah, you know, we're always a good place to stay, right? We have immune compromised kids in our houses all the time. So we look at our environment as some place that we are always focused on, you know, the health and safety of our environment for families. But we are absolutely taking some additional measures, obviously, like the whole world is right now, with screening and masks and, you know, really limiting, you know, I think that the fact that we're at about 40% occupancy now also helps us to have more space inside houses and help with social distancing. But it really does take a lockstep partnership with the infectious disease docs at our partner hospitals, and really monitoring every situation with every family to make sure that we can keep everybody safe and healthy, and prevent, you know, the disease from spreading as well.
You know, I think sometimes it's easy to take for granted technicians or custodial people or anybody that works in an environment like that. I feel that way at the radio station. The people that are constantly cleaning and wiping down our facilities and studios, I don't know that I've thanked them enough in the past. I sure try to now, but that's really, in a way, always been a vital link for how we all go about it, haven't they been?
Absolutely. And, you know, we are missing our army of volunteers right now. That is one of the essential programs that we had to shut down. And, you know, we're a small staff of 80 folks, and then we rely on thousands of volunteers to help us do what we do every day. And those volunteers, you know, are staying at home, so they're not there to help us do all those extra things and those special touches for family. And I really mentioned that we're in the midst of volunteer appreciation this week, and we really do appreciate all those things that volunteers do to help us normally on a day-to-day basis inside of our program.
Any idea when they're going to be able to return?
I do not. You know, we're with everybody else, right? Governor orders and local orders on stay at home, and I suspect that we will not release some of those restrictions until then. So, you know, we're operating a little differently. Our volunteers are helping us in virtual ways. Our meal program, you know, is essential to feeding these families and keeping them nourished during these times of crisis. So I said now we're you know, we're taking lots of donations for packaged meals, and we've become really good at room service door to door for families. But it's hard to say, just like everybody else, when some of those plans we've lifted.
Now, you had a big gala fundraiser that I guess you've had to cancel or put on hold. Did I see an ungala or some sort of remote event you're doing?
Yes. So our UnGala, we are in the midst of a 30-day campaign right now that will all come together at the last 4 days of the month, really April 30 through May 2nd. We rely on that event to raise, you know, over $1 million a year for us, and it is essential to helping meet our fundraising goals, especially during Q2, the beginning of Q3. So it's become a virtual event, and it's got a four-day fun itinerary as we get to April 30th through May 2nd, where families can be involved together, and you can also contribute and give to the mission and share your story. So, it's, you know, we're taking it market-wide in Chicagoland this year. So, you know, you don't have to buy a table to come. You can just get on our website and follow the live streaming events and participate in that way. So,
will you have a live auction?
It looks different.
Will there be an auction online that way?
We will. We'll have an auction and ways to support families. And honestly, just to do things together as a family, we're having game nights and dance-a-thons. I think we have a couple of chefs. Chefs are going to do some cooking recipes and some virtual experiences online. So, you know, we're just finding ways to bring the community together and celebrate the mission, raise awareness, and raise some important resources for the Ronald McDonald House Charities.
I think if I go online and do this, and I think we all will or should, I think you should still put on nice clothes. Put on a pretty dress.
You can put your red shoes on for us if you've got a pair.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, the best place to really check on those happenings is go to our website at ronaldhousechicago.org. And if you go into the events tab, you will see a great menu of all the things that we are doing to put on an UnGala this year.
Let's close with that, Holly. What's that website? How do I get involved?
It's ronaldhousechicago.org.
That'll
take you to our landing page. And then hit the events tab or hit news and stories also if you want to stay abreast of all the things that we need and how you can help during these times of crisis.
That's a good idea. ronaldhousechicago.org.
Chicago.
Got it. Yep. Holly Buckendahl is the chief executive officer there, Ronald McDonald House Charities of Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana. Well done, Holly. Let's visit again. Our best to all of you.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Stay well. 12:41. Okay, now the Wintrust Business Minute.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Lunch, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. The Palmer House has been flagged for a potential loan default. Crane says the owner of the city's second largest hotel missed its April debt payment. The city's hotels have been slammed by a collapse in travel during the pandemic. Do you rely on work printing at your local coffee shop? The shops use Print With Me often, a Chicago startup. Well, the coffee shops are closed these days, so now Print With Me has started home delivery. They print your documents and then drop them off at your door. And the country's big three national credit reporting agencies, Equifax, Experience, and Chicago-based TransUnion, have begun offering free weekly credit reports to help you keep an eye on your credit during the shutdown. They'll be available for the next year. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
Here's a quick look at markets with Steve Bertrand.
The Dow is down 500 points this afternoon, the NASDAQ down 230, and the S&P 500 down 69.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Orion Samuelson joins us. What have you got, O?
The numbers in the grain market, Chicago Board of Trade, the July wheat contract is down 2 cents a bushel, July corn down 3.5 cents, and July soybeans trading higher, up 4.25 cents a bushel. At the Mercantile Exchange, livestock futures mixed today with the June lean hog contract trading up $2.52 a hundredweight. But the June live cattle contract is down 85 cents at $84.25, and the April feeder cattle contract down 97 cents. The governor of Iowa, Kim Reynolds, held a news conference late yesterday and said, basically, meatpacking plants in Iowa must stay open despite coronavirus outbreaks that have sickened hundreds of workers. The governor said shutting the meatpacking plants down would be devastating for farmers and the nation's food supply. She also said that the virus spreads quickly and easily at the plants because so many workers are in close proximity, acknowledging, quote, we will continue to see clusters of positive cases in them. But she also said that these are essential businesses and an essential workforce. Without them, people's lives and our food supplies will be impacted, so we must do our part to keep them open in a safe and responsible way. Coronavirus outbreaks at Tyson Foods pork plants in Columbus Junction and Waterloo, Iowa, and a national beef plant in Tama, Iowa, have contributed to a surge in positive cases in Iowa in recent days. Two-thirds of the 389 new cases announced by the state on Sunday, and that's a one-day record by far, were from the National Beef and the Tyson employees, and other plants across the state from Marshalltown and Perry, Iowa, have confirmed cases as well. The governor said state officials would respond quickly to cases at the plants by making tests available and working to isolate those who are ill and potentially exposed. But as we said earlier, we do not have a food shortage, but we do have a labor problem and a trucking problem as well. But one of the industries benefiting from the pandemic, home gardening. As a matter of fact, not only in the U.S., but around the world, we have a large growth in home gardening because furloughed workers and people working from home are looking for activities to occupy their free time. The U.S. seed company that's been around for well over a century, the W. Attlee Burpee and Company, sold more seed than any time in its 144-year history in March as the contagious respiratory virus spread. And when they cannot find seeds in stores, would-be gardeners in Britain are seeking advice on how to extract them from tomatoes and squash purchased in supermarkets. In Russia, demand for seeds rose by 20% to 30% year on year in March, and seed demand typically goes up in tough economic times, according to Tom Johns, owner of the Territorial Seed Company in Cottage Grove, Oregon. The company temporarily stopped taking orders over the phone due to a surge in demand and reassigned some phone workers to physically fill online orders. So that's one industry that is certainly picking up some steam during the pandemic. That's your money on 720 WGN.
1249 on WGN. This is John Williams. I am produced weekdays from 9 to noon by Ashley Byhun and Elif Garris. Pete Zimmerman is producing the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're here weekdays from noon to 1 at 1249. We're joined by Amy Guth again to follow more business stories, many of them, of course, in the Chicago area. I guess the ESPN docuseries about the Bulls' Last Dance is kind of a Chicago product, isn't it, Amy?
That's exactly right. And so, you know, we're in a moment where people are just so starving for their sports, especially this time of year. So many things people wish they were watching, but of course they have been canceled due to the pandemic. And so ESPN stepped up the release of this documentary called The Last Dance, and it set a ratings record for a documentary airing on the network. So the first night, which was Sunday night, 6.3 million viewers tuned in. They were watching either ESPN or ESPN2 to watch it. And then the second night, another 5.8 million viewers, which is just a huge, huge number, but very, very popular. Ton of conversation around that on social media. And it will come as no surprise, the Chicago market was the top viewing audience of that number of people that were viewing.
I wonder if they are able to calculate people who go back and watch it later, because that Sunday night you had the first two episodes, so you had millions of people watching the first one, and most of them stuck around for the second one. But people could have watched it later in the week as well, right?
I wonder about that, too, because depending on how your cable is set up, what kind of television you had, some people couldn't watch it the first night. 24 hours after, or I don't even think it was that long, shortly after it was aired, that episode, the first episode, was available then to people who would have maybe had to upgrade their cable that first night. So I have that same question that you do of what the viewership looks like later. I'm sure we'll get that later in the month as more episodes come out. People seem to be very, very excited about it. A lot of conversation about it. Even people that you know, were kind of like, I'm kind of lukewarm on basketball, but this was really, really interesting to look at this moment in the team.
12-1 for the Chicago ratings, and then Raleigh-Durham, a 6-5. That's Michael Jordan's college stomping grounds. Norfolk, Charlotte, Greensboro, North Carolina towns, they were dialing in as well. But as much as they're dialed in, we were twice that audience. I'm surprised that the uptick was that much. A 12.1 in the Chicago area for Last Dance. Wow. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with Coca-Cola. Do I understand correctly that they're selling less soda right now?
They are, which surprised me, too. You know, I would imagine people are hanging at home doing that. But where their big, big bulk sales come in, it's the bigger volume of it that go to stadiums, restaurants, things like that, where you see, you know, you press the cup against the dispenser there. That's where a big, big chunk of their sales come in. So that plus people going out less and buying less stuff, they have lost 25% of their volume in the first part of April. They're really hoping for a second half bounce. Coca-Cola worldwide was on track to do really, really well this year. And so they're taking a look, as a lot of companies are, they're taking a look at their big numbers. Another big factor here is Coke was a major sponsor of the Tokyo Olympics. So there's another huge piece. If you think of all the Coke that goes into movie theaters and stadiums and event sponsorship around the world, it really starts to make sense. It almost seems like 25% is a relatively small number for what it could be, but a lot of eyes on what the second half of April will do. They're not anticipating it being much higher, but they do have some optimism. The CEO, James Quincy, said earlier today that this is temporary, but it's still a profound pressure on our customers and our business, but expressed some optimism for what Coke's numbers would look like in the back half of the year. And I think that's what we're seeing. This is a time of year where a lot of companies are releasing their first quarter earnings numbers. And in the coming days, we're going to see a ton of companies talking about this. And I think that's going to be a story we hear again and again of, hey, here's what happened. Here's the numbers tell the story that we all know, but here's what our hope is for the rest of the year. I think we'll see that across industries.
You know, it's a global company, and I think the number was 75% I saw the other day of the Earth's population are living in some sort of lockdown orders. And if that means they can't go to theater productions or concerts or movie theaters where Coke is sold, then they can't go to ball games, then suddenly all of those venues to sell the soda are closed off. I thought people would be drinking soda at home the way they're eating Oreo cookies, but a lot of the places you go to get pop, you just can't, right?
That's exactly right. And if you think about, you know, all the big places where so many Cokes are poured from a fountain, and that's the bulk that I think most of us think about, the bottles that are sold, but that makes up one part of it. But that big, big bulk distribution, that's where their money is, and that's what's really hurting them right now.
Marriott is talking about how this is going to change the hotel business. What are they saying?
I thought this was a really interesting story. So Marriott CEO Arne Sorensen said Monday on Bloomberg TV's Leadership Live, started talking about, well, we've had to look to the future. I think a lot of businesses are thinking this way of what that's going to look like to try to assure people. Because even once stay-home orders are lifted, there's still going to be some fear. There's still going to be some people going, well, is it safe to travel? What if I have to travel for business? How can I be sure? And so Marriott is trying to get ahead of that and thinking about what that's going to look like. They've taken a huge hit, of course. They've had to furlough tens of thousands of workers. They've been forced to close about 25% of their 7,300 hotels around the world. So they've taken a big hit, but they're trying to think down the road and think about what are the things you're going to need to feel safe in a hotel? So that's more rigorous cleaning protocols, masked hotel workers, how people can be kept further apart in hotels. Is that limiting the number of what the occupancy numbers are? What does that do to the restaurants and hotels? So they're trying to think through every step of a guest's a stay and think about where are there opportunities to add more safety protocols. Again, I think we're going to see a lot of businesses talking about the steps they're taking in an effort to try to assure investors and customers that this is something they're taking really seriously and to try to encourage people to be their customers once again.
One last story, Amy. State Farm has given money back to, is it Illinois or is it all other states' businesses?
this is in Illinois. So State Farm is the largest personal lines insurer in Illinois. So they're contributing $10 million to small business relief right here in their home state. Of course, they're based in Bloomington. And this is going to be in the form of low-interest loans to LISC Chicago. That's Local Initiative Support Corporation. They then distribute money to projects and businesses downstate and here in the Chicago area. And they're going to prioritize lending to and aiding women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, veteran-owned businesses, nonprofits with revenue below $5 million, small lenders that are designated for community financial development, things like that, to try to help mitigate some of the damage that have happened to the really small businesses. So State Farm has funded this for about 20 years. It's changed every year what number. It's kind of averaged $7 to $7.5 million each year. But this year they've decided to step it up to 10 to really help people in our state.
Amy Guth reports on business on WGN. We'll talk to you again. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks, John.